This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. We have better maps of the surface of Mars than we do the bottom of the ocean. That's due entirely to unmanned exploration. The rover's Curiosity, Spirit, Opportunity have captured the public's imagination in recent years. Here on Earth, unmanned underwater robots are workhorses of oceanography, giving scientists access to deep-sea volcanoes and the undersides of polar ice shelves. But they seldom make the headlines or become household names, like, say, Alvin or James Cameron's submersible deep-sea Challenger. So today, we're dedicating a full hour to these unsung heroes of oceanography. Here to explain how they work and let us in on some of the latest trends in marine robotics are two leaders in the field. We've got Andy Bowen, principal engineer in the Department of Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering and director of the National Deep Submergence Facility at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and Dr. Hanumant Singh, associate scientist with tenure in the Department of Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering, also at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Now, let's just start with some basic definitions, because there's a whole lot of acronyms that get tossed around. You've got your manned submersibles, essentially the submarines that can go down taking people to the depths of the ocean. Then we've got remotely operated vehicles, and then we've got autonomous underwater vehicles. So what are those two different, the ROVs, the remotely operated vehicles, and the autonomous underwater vehicles?
The remotely operated vehicles tend to be sort of defined by the fact that they have a tether, a physical tether that connects them to their surface vessel and the operators who guide the vehicle's activities directly through that tether cable. So power is being transmitted down and data up along with commands going back down from the pilot. So it's a very interactive tool. It's essentially a way of kind of extending that human presence very directly to the seafloor through that umbilical cable.
So it's literally like having a remote control vehicle.
Exactly. Right. An autonomous vehicle, as the sort of name suggests, is it has no tether cable directly connecting it to the operators, and it goes about its business based on pre-programmed activities and increasingly, and we'll get into this, I expect, during the discussion, increasingly the autonomous systems are capable of exhibiting more complex behavior. And so the lines between tethered vehicles and untethered vehicles or autonomous vehicles and remotely operated vehicles actually are blurring, and it's a really interesting place that we're exploring here at the Oceanographic.
So, Hanu, when is an ROV, a remotely operated vehicle, the right choice? I mean, we've got the manned, we've got remote control, you're basically interactive but not there in person, and then you've got these more autonomous vehicles. When is the right choice for that in between that remotely operated vehicle?
So one interesting thing to think about, Heather, is that, you know, we've got manned submersible. People go down in them. They dive in the morning. They're back in the evening. Then we have the ROVs, which have, as Andy was saying, a tether. You can think of them as a toy on a string. You know, we're dragging them along the seafloor, or they're being flown along the seafloor. And then we have the AUVs, which are just being thrown over the side, pre-programmed missions. And one thing to really stress is that these things aren't really in competition with each other. They're all highly complementary. So, for instance, you could argue that the manned submersibles, they have a critical role in doing certain tasks which are hard to do with the other kinds of vehicles, like manipulation, picking up a sample, working in 3D. The ROVs have, because they have their tether, they have fiber optic cables coming up. You can put lots of sensors there. You can broadcast that data to lots of people on the ship, and increasingly, as you'll find out later in this program, I believe, to lots of people on shore. And but again, they're linked by a tether, so they're tied to the ship. Now, the AUVs, they are really, right now, they're doing the stuff that's really boring. The manned submersibles could do them.
I'm sure there are a few folks here in Woods Hole that would take issue with that.
No. I think it's true. You know, that when you look at the pilots from the ROV and the manned submersibles, they would rather not fly 40 meters off the seafloor, just looking through the midwater column, making multi-beam maps for days on end. And so doing these boring, repetitive tasks is what the AUVs are very, very good at. They're pre-programmed, and they are critical for getting certain amounts of data. But as you know, as I point out, they're all complementary. And then the one other thing which Andy had alluded to earlier is that now some of the distinctions are blurring. So you can have an ROV with a tether, And then you can unplug the tether and make it an AUV, and it can do those boring tasks. And then when you find something really interesting, instead of going back and getting another ROV, you can plug in the tether and grab a sample. So those things are all coming.
How would you unplug and plug in a tether with a vehicle underwater? Let's just technically here.
Yeah, that is a good question. There are systems that have been developed for naval applications that have the capacity to plug and unplug themselves during a singular mission.
So they have like some sort of arm that literally reaches out and grabs a cable and plugs it in?
Almost, yeah. The sort of equivalent of that. So they go about, as Hanu said, the sort of survey tasks, which are relatively simple and quite appropriate for an autonomous system. And then when there's a level of interaction that requires direct human sort of guidance, complex, unstructured tasks, then they sort of click a connector onto themselves, and that gives that real-time connection to the human operators. That's not something that we're doing presently in the research world, but it is definitely a mode of operation that we're doing sort of in a maybe perhaps a more serial fashion. In other words, our Nereus vehicle has the capacity to work both as an autonomous and a tethered vehicle, not during a single dive, but certainly during a single cruise deployment. Yes.
So you could go out, do a little bit of an exploration with an operator guiding it, find the interesting place, and then or find a spot that needs to be explored, and then send it out autonomously to go explore that. And now let's talk about those tethers for a minute, because just the tether technology itself, I think, is really fascinating. I mean, in some cases, you have at this point a vehicle on a tether that's thousands of meters long, right? What does that tether actually consist of? And I mean, how do you keep it from just getting tied up in the middle of the water column?
Well, there are the traditional concept of a tether cable is something that is sort of akin to a cable that would connect your house to the internet, for example. It allows signals to travel through either copper or optical fiber, and in fact also includes the delivery of power. The dilemma that creates is that it's fairly restrictive in terms of the maneuverability and the freedom that a vehicle has, because it's dragging this large, fairly large diameter cable through the ocean. And as you go deeper and deeper, the sort of price you pay for that physical tether becomes greater and greater, to the point where you are forced to reconsider alternatives. And in the case of Nereus, we essentially were able to use a system that put the power on board, because it was really an autonomous vehicle at its core, so it had batteries or has batteries. And really the tether that we used in that case was just very, very tiny glass fiber that provided the pathway for information to and from the vehicle. And it's the abstraction of the tether that really is some of the interesting area where Hanu and I are doing some of our work. I think Hanu's work, for example, extending the capabilities of autonomous systems under ice. So instead of going down to the deepest trenches, we're looking at really extreme environments under very, very difficult operational circumstances, redefining that tethering to allow operators to interact directly with the robot as a really transformative kind of concept that we're building out right now.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Andy Bowen and Dr. Hanu Singh, both of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, about trends in underwater robotics. Now, Hanu, talk a little bit more about this. What do you mean by redefining tether technology?
So, as Andy pointed out, a lot of things we'd like to do are, explore areas we've never been to. And a classical example is working under ice. And we could do that for lots and lots of reasons. And there's a couple of things to think about there. One is a slight digression. One of the big differences between underwater robots and, say, robots in space is and also between what we do in our lab and what most other people do is I think we're slowly transitioning to the point where we'd like to think of these robots as a commodity. So, an example I'd like to use is think of your iPhone. It's a very useful thing. Your smartphone is great, but most people don't name it. And you'd like to keep it for a couple of years, but if it breaks, while it's giving you good service, you don't care as much. You know, you just go out and get one. Now, you know, when we look at a lot of robots, you actually think of some people actually, you know, think of them as they're so precious as a robot itself. They name them, they coddle them, they sit in a hangar instead of going out, and then we don't take the risks with them that we really want to. So we don't put them in harm's way. And that's something we got to get out of. You know, a long time ago, 10 years ago, when we were starting out in robotics, we had a saying that the number of deployments should equal the number of recoveries. You know, otherwise you're going to be having a bad
day. Right, we don't want to lose a robot. These are very expensive robots.
They can be. But now the flip side of that is if you never lose a robot, means you've never really pushed the envelope.
So kind of the if you're not falling, you're not learning thing.
Exactly. And so the idea now is, you know, build them cheaper if you can. And put them out in places where people wouldn't even dream of, under Antarctic ice, for instance, or under in the Arctic. And there's lots of reasons to do that. Some of the reasons might be you're really interested in the science of global warming, what's happening to the ice. We can make measurements from the surface, from satellites, but we still don't know what's happening from a volume perspective because we can't make measurements under ice. Another example is, of course, there's the whole, you know, we all know about Deepwater Horizon and what happened there. What would happen if we had an oil spill under ice? It would be a really big disaster. So questions like this are, you know, some of the questions that are really driving us. And it's interesting, too, to see that, you know, we're all of us are really academics. We're pushing the limits of science. But some of the frontiers that we are pushing are suddenly have added relevance in the commercial world with the offshore companies. And that's led to a slight transition in Woods Hole as well. You know, as you may have heard, we've started this new center called the Center for Marine Robotics, which is aiming towards things like that.
Okay, so level with me. Have you ever lost a robot? And how bad a day would it be if you lost one?
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, I've lost a robot and recovered it 2 days later. And I was, you know, there's a great story there. I you know, now that I'm older, I can recount it, even on public television or public radio. And what happened is we were just working here right off the dock, and we forgot to put the flasher on it. And
what's the flasher?
A flasher is a light which comes on when it gets dark. And it was because it was shallow. We sent the vehicle out. It got stuck on probably a mooring. And, of course, you know, usually what would happen is if it was stuck for several hours and day turns into night, the flasher would come on and we'd see it. And unfortunately, because we thought we were working the day and we'd be done by daylight, we didn't turn the flasher on. And so we didn't see the vehicle. And luckily for us, the tide changed and it probably came off the mooring it was stuck. And next morning we found it on the side of the beach. So, you know, that was a story from 10 years ago. More recently, now that we've, you know, got our checklists in order, we don't make those elementary kinds of mistakes. I think 2 years ago, we were in the Arctic, and we were working off a ship, and the ice conditions were interesting. And when we deployed the vehicle, it got stuck under the ice, and the ice conditions changed dramatically. In fact, we actually got the icebreaker stuck there as well, and we came home without a vehicle.
So you really lost a vehicle. You almost lost an icebreaker.
We wouldn't have lost the icebreaker. We would have, you know, we would have gotten stuck there for an extended period of time. So, yeah, but you know, those are the kind of environments we were working in. So that's it's the cost of doing business.
Okay, so what is the cost of one of these ROVs? Say the robot that you lost under the ice. What's the cost price tag there?
Yeah, the robot we lost was actually an AUV, an autonomous underwater vehicle. The great thing about an ROV is you have a tether and you can pull the vehicle in with a tether if all else breaks, you know. But the AUV we lost was about $500,000.
Now, and that's one of the cheaper ones. That's working towards becoming a commodity, and we're still at $500,000.
That's correct. Now, on the flip side, literally 2 weeks ago, we were in Greenland, and one of the interesting issues there was wanted to work on right next to a calving glacier, and the glaciologists have been working there with small boats, but it doesn't make sense to put people in harm's way 30 meters away from a glacier which is 5 kilometers long and 130 meters high, because a piece of ice can fall on you, and not just the piece of ice, but the wave that it creates can cause havoc on a small boat. So what we did instead is we built a robot, which was in this case an autonomous boat. We drove it right next to the glacier, whereas we could drive it while we were 500 or 600 meters away from it and get some measurements very, very close to the glacier. And in that case, we were there for 10 days. I think on maybe 20 occasions, we came very close to losing that robot. But that robot, by design, was designed to be $25,000. So you know, I think there's all these transition points. There's, you know, the robots are getting cheaper, and still, we still want to use them in these interesting ways.
Now, Andy, let's talk more about how you communicate with a remotely operated vehicle. You can have, as you said, the tethers have gotten much lighter. You're down to just having this little silicon string at this point, basically. Mm-hmm. But of course, one of the challenges is that you're working in water.
Mm-hmm.
There, some of the things that would work in air don't work in water. Are there ways of communicating wirelessly with an ROV through water?
There are, you know, this sort of gearbox, if you will, of communications that are available to us are, as you suggested, a physical tether that, you know, is provides plenty of bandwidth for information between the operators and the vehicle itself. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you kind of have the equivalent of smoke signals or Morse code, and that's acoustic communications, at least what we think of as low-frequency acoustics that travels great distances, but basically there's a limited amount of information you can pack into those signals. You can actually, as the ranges decrease, you can pack, you can elevate the frequency with which you're communicating acoustically, and that allows you to transmit more information. But there's a really exciting development that's taking place at the Oceanographic, which is building systems that allow that are based on communications through light energy. So think of it as you know, flashing your headlights very, very rapidly, and in doing so, you can actually transmit information.
So literally, like optical Morse code to
exactly, yeah. And so we have this sort of spectrum of communication that are available to us, all the way from, as I say, Morse code or smoke signals right up to gigabit Ethernet, which is a physical connection. And the challenge for the engineers and roboticists is to design systems that sort of move elegantly, right, between this communication space. So whereas at the extreme extension where you're relying on smoke signals, you need a robot that's actually quite sophisticated, something that's capable of making decisions on its own. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got a human operator that tells the robot to go left, go right, go up, go down. So one of the challenges is to build a control system that allows us to move between that communication space. I think it's really important to point out that, you know, robots are very good at doing what we tell them to do, but they're really crappy at doing what we want them to do. There's a pretty important distinction between those two things. If you want a robot to go out and make discoveries, that's a pretty challenging objective. If you tell it to do a root survey, it's actually that's likely to be very successful. So
it's the thought process, essentially, that the human thought process of discovery and what is interesting.
Exactly.
That's a very qualitative decision that they're not good at.
That's right. And that's where this sort of, again, blurring that I referred to earlier between, you know, tethered and untethered systems, as the robots become more sophisticated and their sensing capabilities and their sort of ability to think by themselves improves, we can then draw back the need for communications and extend the capabilities. And as Hanu referred, you know, said, really one of our challenges is to provide access to the scientists. And a method for doing that is to put more of these systems out there that are gathering information for the scientific process, and building systems that have this level of autonomy is really an important step in that direction.
Yeah, and you know, to further add to that, I think the big difference, say, in the last 20 years ago, I think we were data limited. We didn't know enough about, we didn't get enough data about the oceans. Now we have a huge data pipeline. But, you know, but what we've realized is that although we have the data, we're still lacking understanding. We want to turn that data into information. So a classic example might be, you know, working with fisheries folks, and they said, oh, we don't have enough pictures of the seafloor. And we wind up with now millions of pictures of the seafloor. And then they suddenly realize, wait a minute, we don't know what to do with those millions of pictures. Okay. And so we have people, we had a program manager who once said to us, you know, what we really want is the very, very basics. We want something that lets us do, you know, count fish and classify them. One fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish.
So that's what you can still, you can do with a robot without the, you're trying to get a robot to be able to do without a human intervention.
That's correct. So we're gathering the data right now, and we're getting very efficient at doing that. But we're still working on getting the robot to understand that data and to extract information, which is what humans are really good at, but not so much the robots.
Now, another thing that humans are pretty good at, but robots tend not to be, is working together. And, you know, you get two minds is better than one, right? So where do we stand on trying to get robots to actually work together? I know this is something that, particularly in the autonomous field, people have been working on for a number of years. Are we trying to get remotely operated vehicles, teams of controllers working together as well?
No doubt. It's an important area that, you know, will allow us to expand the sort of footprint or the presence, right, of these types of systems by promoting kind of a network approach, if you will, to having a larger number of less expensive systems out there, as Hanu referred to, commoditizing the systems that are necessary to sort of explore the ocean. One of the things that's going to allow that to leverage greater understanding for the ocean is their ability to exchange information and to move dynamically through the ocean and gather information, share it between themselves and the human operators, and really, you know, blow open some important understanding of the ocean.
Andy Bowen is principal engineer in the Department of Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering and director of the National Deep Submergence Facility at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Dr. Hanu Singh is associate scientist with tenure in the Department of Applied Ocean Physics and Engineering, also at Woods Hole Oceanographic. We're talking this hour about the latest trends in marine robotics. Still with us is Andy Bowen, director of the National Deep Submergence Facility here at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And joining us now is Dr. Tim Shank, associate scientist with tenure in the biology department at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He and the members of his lab have taken the remote part of remotely operated vehicle to an extreme. They've spent the past 6 weeks exploring undersea canyons from the comfort of their own lab via live stream video. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
So, tell us about this live stream video technology. You've been doing this for a few years with a ship that is operated by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, where essentially you're going out and exploring, but you don't actually have to be on the ship. So what's the setup on the ship and what's the setup in your lab that's enabling this?
Yeah, that's right, Heather. Since 2010, we've been working with the NOAA Oceanus Explorer vessel to provide data real time through the internet, basically. So that we can observe the seafloor and go places we haven't been before. They're very hard to get to. You heard in the last half hour about Andy and Hanu talking about the remotely operated vehicles and these great deep submergence tools that we have. But it's how you deploy them for research and science that really make the difference for us. And so in 2010, we went out to Indonesia. The deep sea in the north of Indonesia, the Sulawesi Sea, was really unknown at that point. No one had ever been down there before. And that's almost right in the heart of the Coral Triangle, a place that we know that has the most diverse deep sea life, shallow water sea life on Earth. And so we want to know if that translated to the deep sea. And so getting this ship, this dedicated ship of exploration, a dedicated ROV is what we had, a tethered vehicle. And I was the only scientist on board. It has a full operating ROV crew on board. It has videographers that do NFL football games, very high expertise on board the ship. It's dedicated for that sole purpose of exploring the seafloor, going where we haven't gone before, and transmitting that live back to shore for scientists to observe.
So just for a second, tell us about what the experience is like being on a boat, doing science with a remotely operated vehicle. I mean, you're sitting in kind of a, it's usually just a trailer, right? Literally a trailer that comes off the back of a truck that
That's
is
right.
loaded with all of these video screens. You're sitting there with
That's right.
presumably other people who are operating the vehicle.
Yeah. And you typically have a pilot and a co-pilot, and you have a navigator who's sitting in the front row. You have a videographer or two that are sitting up in the front row, listening to your instructions of what you want to see. If you want to stop and image something, look at something, zoom in on something, get more information about something. You're in the back row. And again, I was the only scientist on board, a whole different paradigm. Normally you would have, maybe 18 to scientists on board, doing different disciplines, you know, biologists, geologists, chemists. But in this case, it was by myself, basically, and relying on those geologists and chemists back on shore to give me information. And so we were plugged in live to them in my little headset there. They could talk to me and I could talk to them. And they could tell me, Tim, we want to see this. Can you go back and look at this? Stop the vehicle. Let's look at this. And that's what we do. So as a team, we'd work together to explore and learn more.
So was it as good having them on the other end of your headphones as it was having them in the trailer there with you?
It's extremely difficult. Normally, you don't have that off-the-ship presence. And so all the people who are watching with you are in the room, like watching TV in your living room and having discussions. But when they're on the shore, you have to wait for them to get your message and come back to you. You're hearing the pilot speak. You know, three or four people are in your headset while you're trying to listen to somebody else on shore. It's extremely difficult. It's a whole new way of participating in ROV science.
Well, so and then now you've taken this 3 years later. This summer, you've just completed 6 weeks where, in fact, you weren't on the ship. There were two other scientists who were on the ship. But now you've got this much larger community. You were plugged into, what, something like 40 different locations via three or four different communications technologies. So talk a little bit about what was going on in your lab here in Woods Hole this summer.
It's grown tremendously. That first year we had maybe 10 scientists involved. And like you said, there were 40. There was actually over 700,000 people watching our three live feeds coming off the ship. In my lab, I had 8 people. I had summer student fellows, I had postdocs, I had technicians, I had graduate students, all learning about the deep sea in real time from the experts in the field, right? We were off 100 miles or so off of Nantucket, looking at deep water canyons, a place that's virtually unexplored. It's within our economic zone of the U.S., yet we know little about what lives there, the living resources, non-living resources. We had a lot of stakeholders involved who wanted to know about whether we have natural seeps of petroleum there. The oil companies wanted to know that. Fisheries biologists and the councils on the East Coast want to know what the fish are, what the deep water corals are. But without getting too far into that, we had teams set up around the country and around the world. We had some in France that were also watching us, interacting with us. We were learning about – it was fantastic, Heather. And that we were learning about the experience from other scientists and what they had done in deep water canyons or in the deep sea with their expertise.
Well, and you said at one point there was, I think it was a fish that nobody knew what it was, and you literally picked up a phone to someone who was not already plugged into the cruise and said, wake up, you know, in your time zone, you're still asleep, wake up, get on your computer, we need to know what this fish is now. So you could literally, it was kind of plug and play for scientists, right? You could just plug in the people who needed to be at any point.
We did that many times with sponges and with fish and with other animals, even with the geology. We plug people in and say, hey, have you seen this before? And it really, what it's doing is it's advancing science at an accelerated rate. What would take us, we come back normally, right, with all of our data on hard drives, and we'd go through it, and we might send images out to people or talk to people at meetings and slowly gain, whoa, that was really new, right? And this now we're doing it while we're in real time, before we even, you know, the cruise is over, right? So I think it's accelerating the discovery of things in the deep sea for sure. I think it's going to push technologies even harder. You heard Hanu and Andy talk about going under ice and exploring. A lot of scientific reasons to do so. But we need more tools for that. What is a biologist going to need under the ice in the Arctic or Antarctica? And so it's going to be a little bit different. And for me, I'm an evolutionary biologist, and so I'm trying to sample animals from all around the world and see how they're related, right? You can't do that by using the standard traditional, let's use a submarine and go here. It's expensive to take a submarine, right, to far-flung places. And so it takes the types of vehicles and submergence assets you've just been hearing about, autonomous underwater vehicles to make the first map so the ROV can go back and dive there and look at the animals and discover what's there. This program with NOAA, Ocean Exploration Office, is really advancing, accelerating science by going to places that are far-flung, and as well as in our own backyard. Did you know that we're not even sure what our exclusive economic zone is, right? We're told that it's 200 miles off our coastline. But the reality is that we don't even know how far that – once you go 200 miles, if there is a ridge or a slope that extends from that, that's also ours. But we don't know where that is.
We don't have the maps to actually know what's on the seafloor there.
In short, the underwater boundaries of our nation are unknown and unexplored. There's living resources. There's non-living resources out there we don't know about. These canyons we have right here, we discovered natural seeps. There are four of them. right, where we have hydrocarbons coming out of the seafloor, methane coming out of the seafloor, frozen methane is down there, right? All this can be used or harnessed for as a resource for our country, right?
But we just haven't explored it yet.
That's right.
Now, obviously, there's a lot of technology involved in broadcasting this data back, having this live, interactive, and especially if you've got it at 40 locations or something, you've got a lot of technology involved. But you're also getting a lot more people involved that you wouldn't be able to – the cost of putting that many people on a ship, you would never be able to do that. And it costs tens of thousands of dollars per day per person to actually be out on that ship. So is what you're doing a cost savings, or is it more expensive because you've got all this communications technology, or do you actually have a cost savings going on here?
So this communication technology existed 30 years ago. This was done with JSON, where they would broadcast things. As soon as it was realized, you could broadcast from an ROV to the ship. Say, wait a minute, why can't we broadcast it off the ship by satellite? And they did that in the 80s. But mostly it went to classrooms and maybe some museums.
And it was a one-way thing?
And it was a one-way thing. Well, it was sort of a two-way thing. You could do a little bit two-way, but it was mostly let's show the kids what they can see and discover like that. But now the bandwidth is so great, the internet's so great, that we have three streams coming off the ship. Anybody can tune in. I was watching it on my iPhone. It's that simple. I could hear all the scientists talking through the conference call that we do, see the video in real time with my iPhone, and I could dial in and call the scientists through that, right, driving down Woods Hole Road. So the technology is all there now, right? It's just what we're going to do. What are we going to do with it now that we have it, right?
So ocean science, I think, is one field. You know, there's been a real blossoming of citizen science, this movement to get all sorts of people involved in the actual doing of science. But it's always been very hard to do that with ocean science because, of course, you can't get everybody out on a ship. Now you have the ability, as you said, there could be a class of a bunch of students on the conference call watching this feed, and they could literally say, hey, can you go back over there and look at this? And the ROV operators would be responding to these requests from students, from anybody, from any of these 700,000 people who are watching, not just from the two scientists that are on board the ship. Right?
This is what was unexpected, I think, when we first started this. I mean, normally you go out to sea, again, you may have 18 scientists out there. They may have four or six graduate students out there doing their PhDs and very exclusive, if you will, right, for access. Now it's clear, like I told you, I had eight people in my lab this summer. Now they came in with no knowledge of deep sea biology, and they're leaving now with, you know, they're writing reports on it. And so it's the reach is so far, it's up to us to see what the limit is, right? What are we going to do with this now that we can do it? There was a meeting last month we had about how to harness telepresence, exploration and research for developing curricula for classrooms. And really not just, oh, gee whiz, look at this, right? It's not what it's about. It's about what science can we advance through exploration and knowledge, right? And so what's amazing is that we had a graduate student actually led one of our cruises this summer, right? She was actually in that hot seat that I told you I was in, and I mean, did a fantastic job. And if you ask her what she got out of it, she learned more than she would ever learn in a 6-year PhD program about deep sea biology and geology, right? You can't get, I don't know anywhere else you can get that full scope and richness of an education. Honestly,
you have to learn by doing.
And you're also now has collaborators around the world that she can pull from and talk to that, you know, saw how hard she worked and what she was able to do. And it's an avenue that we haven't seen for education, right? That we have this avenue now to educate students very rapidly, right? I had to wait a year and a half before my first deep sea cruise, right? And I looked at video the whole time and I tried to educate myself, but I wasn't talking to experts. This person made a fundamental leap.
And I came and visited your lab last Friday, and you were saying one of the benefits is that by having this education and learning by doing from the lab, obviously this is not going to do away with the more traditional model of sending scientists out on ships to do this. But now when you or your grad students actually are the one out there on the ship or out there doing a cruise that might not be a broadcast cruise, you have this education, this wealth of information and expertise that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
That's right. That's exactly true. And so it's what do you do with the students when you're not just having them watch passively like it's TV or something. They're calling and talking to the scientists. They're generating reports and making catalogs and inventories of what we're doing. I mean, so they're we're actually doing presence and absence data, for example, of corals, and I'm having them analyze it right now today. And so we're able to use these real-time data and post-processing to educate these students.
So you're accelerating the pace by having everybody feeding in at the same time and talking to each other. But are there actual discoveries that wouldn't have happened even eventually, that would never have happened, or outcomes coming out of this cruise that would never have happened if you hadn't had everybody working on it all together?
Well, there's no doubt. First of all, we would never have had the cruise. There are very few places or agencies that will fund exploration, period. And we had the experts around the world saying, you know, we never get to do this. So, we never get just to go look and experience and take our time. So
when you say exploration, what do you mean? Isn't that what is being funded when we go out on these ships with AUVs or ROVs or with Alvin? No. Isn't that exploration?
No, you don't get the privilege of using those vehicles unless you have written a proposal that has well-defined hypotheses, well-constrained experiments, has to have clear results that are going to lead you to a certain conclusion either way. That's science. That's a scientific method, right? And so what we often lack is the enough information and data to write that proposal. How do you write a proposal on the canyons we have out here off our coast if we don't know what's out there at all, right?
So this is giving you the ability to just
it's opening up
go look and
new avenues of research. Absolutely. No doubt about it.
I mean, that's what it felt like when I was in the lab with you, was that it was literally almost like just kind of going for a walk on the bottom of the ocean, that there wasn't this – we have to pick this up. We have to do this experiment. We have to answer this question. It was, let's just go for a walk and look.
Right. But the fear that you have is that people take this as a gee whiz thing. We're going down there and we're looking in that. What beautiful imagery we have. We have some of the best cameras, you know, you can get. And it's fantastic, right? We're getting views of, I'm able to count the teeth and spines on the back of a shrimp. It's so good. And so it's not just gee whiz, golly, what nice images. It's that we're now have questions that we, first of all, it took a year to get to this point for this Canyons cruise, for example. We had workshops and meetings that people defined what they wanted to do. We had preliminary hypotheses about what we thought might be there, right, and why. And that sets us up, right? It gives us a framework to go out and explore. I mean, these canyons go from 400 meters down to 4,000 meters. Where are you going to go? You're going to cover maybe a half a mile during one dive, right? And there's millions and millions and millions of square miles out there. So we have to narrow that down to begin with. So there's a scope already when we go out and explore. It's not just random walking, right? We have a purpose behind it. And that's really important for people to understand. And when it comes to what we're seeing, right, and what we're conveying to our graduate students, what is benefiting our research, is like drinking from a fire hose. You know, you were in there seeing us at some pace that we've come to have on these dives. We stop and we look at certain things, right? As we go along, we document things, we have questions about things that we know are going to feed into proposals for us to come back and do research. You know, but we have daily phone calls with the scientists. After the dive is over, we come and we gather on a conference call. We give summaries and we give our impressions and our thoughts. And through those, we're developing new collaborations. And now I think we're up to perhaps 14 types of publications that we do as scientists already on this. So it's not let's go look, gee whiz. It's what's going to enable our science in the future if we go and look here.
Now, let's talk about the collaborations that come out of this as well. Because, of course, when you've got 40 people talking to each other, some of what happens is that you start talking about we need to work together more on this. And that is in and of itself a tangible scientific outcome from these cruises, isn't it?
Absolutely true. That you wouldn't have – you might gain that at some sort of a national meeting or something like that, and you would find someone to connect with them and share your interests. But you're developing these relationships in real time, and when it's over, you've shared an experience. You know, everybody's sort of shaking hands at the end saying, what a great job, nice, let's keep talking about this. Remember, we wanted to do that. And, you know, so you're absolutely right. This is a benefit that people maybe didn't see before when we started this. But definitely having a major collaborations coming out of this.
Now, the ROV that you've been using with the Okeanos is purely going down and taking video. There's no ability to grab a sample to pick stuff up while you're down there. Right. There are other ROVs that have that ability, that have a robotic arm on them, and you can say, I want a piece of that coral. I want that brittle star. I want that egg mass that we don't know what it is. So do you ever wish that you had, when you're on these telepresence cruises, that you had one of those robots? How important is it to be able to grab what it is you're seeing?
Well, it's extremely important. The imagery can only get us so far, even though it's really good imagery. can only get us so far. We actually have to have a sample. We can't describe a new species from a picture, right? And so we all recognize that the current limitations are there. Now, that this ROV called the Deep Discoverer is new. It's its second science mission, right, of exploration. And it does have two manipulator arms, so it can sample. The issue when you have such an open community thing, I haven't told you that yet, but all the data here are shared. Everything that comes off the vehicle, all the depth and temperature data and all the video and still imagery, all gets archived in the National Archives. It's on an FTP site within 24 hours. It's total open source. And that's the way things are going. And so anybody can write any paper, do any proposal they want to, go out and make any collaborations they want to. The key thing will be for the future to see how we can get samples. Right now, what if you did sample a shrimp, for example, or a fish? There may be 20 people that want that fish. Right? What are you going to do? Normally, if you had your own funded program to go out, that would be for the chief scientist to say. There is no chief scientist. There's only a science team lead on these cruises. The chief scientist would normally say, okay, you're going to get that fish, and you're going to do that with it, and when you're done, we're going to send it to so-and-so and do this research. Right now, we haven't figured out the protocol for if we take a fish, who's going to get it? Because there's so many people that want it. It may be that we take that fish and we get, you know, accession it into the Smithsonian, some national archive, and then as we normally do, we make requests from that archive, and the person at the archive place has to deal with who's going to get that sample. But right now you can't cut a shrimp up into 10 bits and hand it out to 10 people. And so I think next year we'll have this solved.
So I mean, that's one of the challenges of opening this up to so many people is suddenly you've got this real conundrum.
That's right. And people want samples. We found what we think are many new species on this, fish and coral species on this recent cruise, and we desperately want those samples.
Do you worry that when you go back to get those samples, you might not be able to find that fish?
No, that's never really – that hasn't been a worry, actually. I think that, like I told you before, these cruises enable research to happen. They enable proposals and follow on. That's the real goal of these things, not to be the end-all, be-all, you know, get all research done. So the idea is to give enough preliminary information to say we know where the new coral species is. We think it is. We know where the new fish species is living and habitat it's in, and we want to go back. And that's what we're looking to really do.
Now – go ahead.
Yeah. No, I was going to say that even if we had a twig of a coral, right, to come back, that would really advance the discovery much more, right, and enable us to say more and do more and give other agencies the confidence with which to fund us. So I'm looking forward to that happening. I hope we can work out a protocol that's agreeable with the community.
Now, a month or so ago, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution posted on their Facebook page one of these live stream videos and said that this summer 2013, could go down as the summer of live stream oceanography. You've been doing this for 3 years. Mm-hmm. We've had the ability to do this since the 80s. Mm-hmm. What's happening now that there's this sudden explosion in doing oceanography by remote feed like this?
That's a great question. What's happening now is that those scientists who get funded through, let's say, the National Science Foundation or other agencies to do their specific program and crews like we talked about, they are now so interested in telepresence and presenting themselves and their project for education that they are now taking remote telepresence units out to sea with them. So our ship here, the Atlantis, has such a remote thing on it right now. So if there's an ROV dive off the Atlantis tomorrow, they can use telepresence. They can put that on the internet. People can look and participate as they will. So case-by-case basis for scientific research programs that are going out to sea now are incorporating telepresence more and more. We've got a trip. The ship Nautilus is out now, going to be going to Grand Cayman. They leave port today. They're going to be broadcasting that live on nautilus.org. There's a new web portal called Exploration Now, which actually features ships that have telepresence capabilities with different types of science programs on them. Some are exploration. Some are sort of the ships are hired guns by NSF or other agencies with specific research programs that people are going to feature. I did this last year on the Revel, the script ship Revel, and it was really fascinating to see a different approach. It wasn't exploration. We were doing our scientific mission, very, you know, constrained and determined, and we all sat in the chair and we conveyed our science and what we're doing. And it was tremendous. But it was mostly one way, right?
Oh, so that's mostly a one-way thing.
We did not have other people participating on shore, you know, saying, you know, turn left, turn right, I want to see this.
Is there any pushback? Are there those in the community who don't necessarily think we should be opening it up in this way, that it should be just this more exclusive, the scientist, the credentialed scientist doing it, and it should just be a one-way feed?
What we're finding is that the more we do this sort of open communications, open scientific exploration that we're talking about, we get more and more people every year involved. More and more want to be on the ship and actually do the work on the ship. I think we're finding more and more that people who have funded programs want telepresence technology with them. They see it's a masterful way to educate the public and other people in schools and classrooms. And you reach anybody you want to reach, right, immediately.
Dr. Tim Shank of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Tim, as always, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Heather.